Chapter 3.
Got a lot of respect in this town, Mr. Steele.
He thought about those words as he stood on the sidewalk outside the bar. Respect. An elusive commodity. And there were different kinds of respect. When he had been an ordinary strike force officer, he had respect. But it was a respect based on submission to authority. Most citizens were never very comfortable around police officers, unless they knew them very well. And not many wanted to. He still recalled Janice's first reaction to him. She had not liked cops. Mick had warned him about that. Janice had been best friends with Mick's sister.
She can be a real cunt sometimes,
he said. And then he had grinned.
But she's a fucking knockout.
She was, too. She possessed that unattainable, frosty blonde beauty that Steele had always associated with models and actresses. But she was a government employee who worked for city administration, and Steele had not found her to be a real cunt. He had been attracted to her immediately, a powerful chemical attraction, unlike anything he'd ever experienced before. He knew she felt it too. They'd made ferocious eye contact all through dinner, and afterwards, when he walked her back to her apartment, she had invited him in, and they had slept together. And it had been incredible. But Janice was conflicted. Janice did not like cops. She did not like that what she perceived as their arrogance and swaggering manner. She hated listening to them talk about what happened on the job. Steele had thought he understood that. He thought, in time, she would get over it, but she never really did. The bottom line, as Father Casey had explained to him during one of their informal counseling sessions, was that Janice was one of those people who liked to remain insulated from certain of life's harsher realities. She had found a niche for herself, a comfortable existence in a steady, relatively undemanding job, a security high-rise in a reasonably safe neighborhood, and a circle of friends who reflected her values and her outlook on life. But her outlook on life did not include some of those harsher realities, and she did not want to know about them. She felt threatened by them, and Steele represented them. He lived with them every day. They came back home with him, because he came home. Janice had respected Steele the man, but she had not respected Steele the cop. The trouble was, she couldn't have one without the other. And in the end, she chose not to respect the marriage. He'd experienced another sort of respect after he became a cyborg. At first, he had been a curiosity, and an unsettling one at that. When the story about him had first been released, the people he encountered had stared at him with a mixture of fear and fascination. He appeared perfectly normal, but they knew he wasn't. They had stared, looking to see if there was anything different they could spot about him, their gazes sliding away from his whenever he looked back at them. That had been respect, too. Respect based on fear, fear of the alien among them. It all changed after he averted Cord's attempt at a military coup. The story that had come out after the fact, and now everybody knew that Cord and his crack troops had seized a pre-war missile base in Wyoming and had threatened to nuke New York if the government did not capitulate. Steele had led the assault force that took the base, and now he was a hero. Now, instead of looking at him as if he were some sort of alien creature, people asked for his autograph and brought him drinks, and women propositioned him. He couldn't help but wonder about their motivations, especially the women. Was it merely the allure of fame? Or was it something more subtle, perhaps even perverse? What's it like to fuck a cyborg? There had been a magazine article done about him recently in which the writer, a woman, had teasingly speculated on that possibility. He had refused the interview, but that hadn't stopped her from writing the piece anyway. She had researched her subject, reviewing all the media coverage he'd received, and she'd checked out his specs, as she referred to them. There was a limit to how much she had been able to find out, because most of the details about his construction were classified, but she had been able to find out which parts of him were artificial and which parts were still organic. And by a simple process of elimination, she had been able to draw her inferences. Between interviewing scientists and engineers who had nothing to do with the project and speculating on her own, she had drawn the conclusion that he was still primarily organic in his essential bodily functions. Only his cybernetic brain gave him an almost superhuman level of control over them, which certainly raises some rather interesting possibilities. He'd received his first proposition within a day after that article hit the stands. Would they be so interested, Steele wondered, if they really knew what it was like to be with him? If they knew about the nagging doubts and fears, the nightmares that often woke him crying out in the middle of the night, the danger of being in his proximity? Susan Carmody had died simply because she had been with him at the wrong time when assassins of the Bordini family had tried to machine gun him with armor-piercing bullets. The Delano family had a contract out on him, as did the Pistores and the Castellanos and every other street gang in No Man's Land. He lives in a well-guarded government building with armed agents in the lobby and on the roof and gun emplacements protecting the airspace around his penthouse. He took the restricted underground shuttle between his building, which also housed government officials, and the federal building. But anytime he went out to the streets alone, such as now, he was on his own. He was not an easy man to kill, but anyone who happened to be with him could also be a target. He made sure that Raven never went anywhere unarmed, and he had drilled her in firearms technique until she was an expert shot and taught her unarmed combat. He didn't like it if she went out alone. He'd always tried to make sure Ice went with her. No, being with a cyborg had some definite disadvantages. He suddenly realized that he was afraid to go back home. If his ghost personality syndrome was starting to cause some sort of electronic schizophrenia, there was a chance that he could go psychotic, just as Mick had. He had already started hearing voices, his own no less. He was afraid for Raven. The thought of hurting her was more than he could bear. He needed time to think. Only he could no longer trusted his thoughts. Where do you go, he thought, to escape yourself? If he had really started losing it, he thought, he'd kill himself. It shouldn't be too difficult. He was a walking arsenal. He could simply stick the firing tube of his built-in laser in his mouth, neutralize his pain circuits, and burn through the nice steel casing that had protected his cybernetic brain until it was reduced to slag. They had the ability to rebuild him, but thanks to Senator Carmen, now they wouldn't be able to. It would be a neat solution to his problems, except he didn't want to die. He was angry, and he wanted to strike out at someone. He thought of Mick again. Was that how it had started? He didn't want to go back again. He couldn't trust himself with Raven. Not until he worked it out, one way or another. If his brain started to malfunction seriously, would he have enough time? Would he have enough self-control to do what would have to be done? He simply didn't know. He started walking, aimlessly, heading south into No Man's Land. As he approached the border at Houston Street, the neighborhood grew visibly worse. There was no actual formal border in the sense of gates or walls or guard posts. Nothing to prevent the people in No Man's Land from crossing over into Lower Midtown. They often did, but the police patrolled the area regularly. And the strike force made routine forays across the border every day in an effort to keep the area pacified. It was like an urban version of jungle warfare. They'd get one area of No Man's Land more or less under control, only to have another area erupt and be forced to shift their manpower there, while the area they just pacified fell back under gang domination. It kept going back and forth that way, with no one really making any headway. The virus left the population of the city decimated. More than decimated. It was now only a fraction of what it had been. The birth rate had been rising steadily over the past 50 years, but it would still be a long time before the population provided enough density and enough human resources to rehabilitate the entire island of Manhattan. However, the population in No Man's Land was rising steadily as well, and the poverty-stricken, disenfranchised people who resided there had little reason to love the cities of Midtown. They felt abandoned, and in a very real sense, they were. In the immediate aftermath of the war, the city had been reduced to an almost total anarchy. As society had struggled to reorganize itself after the disaster, there was a limit to what the strained resources could do. Even today, years after the initial onslaught of the virus and the brief aborted nuclear exchange, there was still food shortages and there were not enough essential services to go around. The armed forces had their hands full trying to bring the outlying areas back under control and protect the agro communes that kept the towns and cities fed. Urban police departments struggled to perform the task of Sisyphus to figure out in case you didn't know who Sisyphus was, the figure out of Greek mythology who was condemned to roll a giant boulder up a steep hill, only to have it repeatedly rolled down to the bottom before he could attain the summit. In New York City, just as in other surviving cities all across the country, the beleaguered police force could only manage to protect a limited area, and consequently, the areas where the wealthy and the powerful lived received the first priority. The ghettos were largely left to struggle on their own. In the absence of any kind of organized authority to protect their citizens, the ghetto street gangs had organized in order to protect their neighborhoods. And they did provide protection, of a sort. But they also called the tune. In time, they came to virtually control the economy of their urban jungle. And they established strong connections with the powerful organized crime families in the outlying enclaves, beyond government control. They frequently warred amongst each other, and the ghetto residents were both dependent on them and completely at their mercy. The people in the ghettos were denied most of the benefits enjoyed by the citizens of Midtown. They were denied jobs, though some of them were able to secure employment by maintaining the complicated fiction of a residence in Midtown. They were denied essential services, such as sanitation and hospitals, except those operated by the gangs and staffed by a few dedicated workers and physicians who were motivated by the oath of Hippocrates. Why do you write it that way? The oath of Hippocrates, rather than the rule of the almighty dollar. They were, in many cases, even denied such essential necessities as power and running water. They were like those poor, benighted peasants in Poe's story, The Mask of the Red Death, locked out of the castle and falling to the plague while the lord and his fawning aristocrats danced and feasted in luxury behind the massive iron gates. There wasn't much to keep them from overrunning Midtown like an angry horde, except a police force armed to the teeth. They had very little love, indeed, for the citizens of Midtown, even less for the police. As Steele crossed over into No Man's Land, it was like entering a DMZ. The streets were cracked and buckled, strewn with rat-infested garbage. Many of the buildings were abandoned, and all were falling into disrepair, dark except for the surreal sights of the campfires flickering inside powerless apartments. Often, there were fires, and no one came to put them out. It was an eerie scene, dark, ominous, and ghostly. Occasionally, music could be heard, coming from portable radios tuned into stations broadcasting from Midtown. It was never classical. No Man's Land moved to a different, more primitive beat. Three large gangs controlled the southern Manhattan. And that's what it says. Three large gangs controlled the southern Manhattan. Okay. The Chingos, the Dragons, and the Lords. Lords are new. The Chingos were largely Hispanic, the Lords ruled Little Italy, and the Dragons were all of Asian American descent. None of them had any great fondness for the others. Jake Hardass Hardesty, the commander of Strike Force, had often said, though never for the record, that what they really ought to do is seal those bastards off inside there and let them kill each other off! There have been times when Steele had agreed with him, and there have been other times when he really couldn't blame the gangs. But it wasn't the sort of question that could be seen in simple terms of black and white. Undeniably, the gangs did a lot of good for the people of their blighted neighborhoods. They often brutalized them as well. Steele knew he was asking for trouble walking along these streets. He was baiting them. Trouble was exactly what he wanted now. It was what he needed. Something to take his mind off the doubts and indecisions. Something to take away the fear. Most people would have probably found that extremely strange, even crazy. Troubled by depression? Confused? Plagued by nagging self-doubt and anxiety? Go out and find yourself a war. Have people shoot at you. But it wasn't just because he was a cyborg, far more powerful and more deadly than any ordinary man, therefore having less to fear. There were ordinary men who felt the same way, too. There always had been. They seemed to function at their best in combat, with adrenaline coursing through their systems, their reflexes at a peak, their minds in a state of razor-sharp clarity that no other situation could duplicate. Put them back into the everyday world, and they often became drunks or drug addicts. They could not hold down a job. They couldn't maintain a relationship. MacArthur had said it best, perhaps. Old soldiers never die. They simply fade away. But no one had understood what he really meant, except old soldiers. Someone screamed out in the night and kept screaming. Steele ran toward the sound, his cybernetic senses triangulating on it, homing him in with perfect accuracy. As he ran at a pace no ordinary human could possibly hope to match, he turned up his hearing, and his computer brain started sorting through the cacophony of sounds he suddenly picked up. Music playing, people tossing in their beds and snoring or arguing or making love, rats scurrying through the refuse, old buildings creaking as they settled. It filtered them and concentrated on the sounds issuing from the location he'd identified. He found the building the screams were coming from and raced inside, rang up the stairs, taking the steps three and four at a time. The sounds were much sharper now and clearer. Male voices cursing, the soft thudding sounds of blows on flesh, and the muffled sounds of someone trying to scream. And the walls of the stairwell were covered with graffiti. The landings were choked with filth and garbage. Plaster had fallen from the ceilings, exploding old lath and rusty pipes, and wiring that had never been done according to code. The whole place smelled of urine, damp, and decay. Steele came out to the corridor of the fourth floor. It was empty. The walls had been defaced, so there were no lights on anywhere because there was no power. There was no heat, either, or running water. The building looked abandoned, but people lived here in incredible squalor. He could hear them inside their apartments, behind closed and probably barricaded doors. They'd heard the screams, but they knew better than to indulge their curiosity. If they even had any curiosity. Somebody else was screaming. Someone else. At least it wasn't them. Still came to the door of the apartment from which the screams had come. He could now hear muffled sobbing, the grunts and groans of somebody in pain, the continued thuds of blows falling, several males cursing, one of them laughing, another saying, "Kick the motherfucker's brains out, man!" He tried the knob. It turned freely. He opened the door and entered the apartment. The room was garishly illuminated by flames flickering inside a metal trash can in the corner of the room. Three young, long-haired white males in the gang colors of the Lords were kicking a man who huddled on the floor, trying to curl himself up into a ball. A fourth was restraining a young girl who couldn't have been more than 13 or 14 years old, his hand clamped over her mouth. She was very pretty, with long, coltish legs, long dark hair, and brown eyes that were open wide in horror and terror as she stared at the man being kicked. Her flimsy nightgown had been torn and was hanging off one shoulder, exposing a young breast. "What the fuck do you want, man?" The gang member restraining her snapped as Steele came in. "You," Steele said, standing just inside the doorway. The other three stopped kicking the man on the floor and turned toward him. They were wearing old, torn jeans and heavy boots with chains around them, cut-off sweatshirts exposing their tattooed arms, earrings, and neck chains, or leather chokers, black, spiked wristbands, and studded leather vests, festooned with pins and chains and painted decorations with the name Lords written in scarlet script across their backs. They looked like a cross between pirates and barbarians.
"What look are we at here?" said one of them in a snide tone. "A fucking hero! A fucking hero who's about to have his fucking head handed to him." "Let the girl go!" said Steele. "Oh, what, hero? What the fuck you gonna do, man? Think you could take all four of us? Huh?"
Steele could easily have shot all four of them in time it took him to reply, but that would have been too quick. It would have been over much too soon. He wanted this. He needed it to last a while. He was just a shadowy figure to them. They hadn't recognized him yet, but in another few seconds, they would.
"I don't think," he said. "I know."
"Is that right?"
said the gang member, a thin-lipped, sallow-faced young man in his 20s, with dark hair that hung low below his shoulders. He whipped his gun out of his shoulder holster, a black 9mm double-action semi-auto. He lifted his arm and aimed it directly at Steele's chest.
"Shoot him, Tony! Shoot him!"
said one of the others, urged him.
"You think you could stop a bullet, hero?"
Tony said, his lips curling in a sneering smile.
"Suck my dick, greaseball,"
Steele said. God damn it. The smile dropped from Tony's face.
"All right, asshole, you asked for it."
He fired. Steele felt the impact as the 9mm slug struck his chest at point-blank range, but failed to penetrate his polymer skin. He smiled.
"Looks like I can stop a bullet, doesn't it?"
he said. Tony stared at him with disbelief.
"Oh man, you missed!"
one of the others said with disgust.
"How the hell could you miss him at this range?" "Shut up!"
snapped Tony.
"I ain't gonna fucking miss him this time!" "Wrong!"
said Steele. He switched on his laser designator and his eyes suddenly glowed red as twin laser beams lanced out from them and focused on the gun. Before Tony could react, Steele's laser tube slid out through the gun port in his palm and he fired. The pistol glowed bright red as the beam struck it, and Tony cried out, dropping it to the floor.
"You only get one chance," said Steele.
"Holy shit! It's him!"
one of the others cried. They clawed for their guns. Moving so quickly that they could only saw a blur, Steele drew his Colt 45 and fired twice in rapid succession. He struck their guns with unerring accuracy, and they clattered to the floor as the gang members cried out and clutched their wrists. The fourth one was still holding the girl. He looked around wildly. Steele stood between them and the door. The gang member glanced toward the open window and the fire escape.
"Go for it!"
Steele said, the twin red beams of his laser designator striking the pupils of the kid's eyes and making him squint and turn away.
"Go ahead. See if you make it." "Get him, man!"
shouted Tony.
"You fucking get him!"
one of the others replied, backing away, eyes wide with fear. The third one lunged for the couch and came up with the Uzi he must have put down on it when they had started in on their victim. "No, no," thought Steele. "Not yet. Not yet." He fired his Colt twice. The bullet struck the Uzi, and the kid cried out and dropped it. Tony pulled a large combat bowie out of his boot and crouched down over the man they had been kicking. He jerked his head up by his hair and put the knife blade to his throat.
Back off, Steel! Back off right now, or I cut this motherfucker's throat!
Steel raised his .45 and shot him right between the eyes. The red beams of his gaze swept across the room and pinned down the gang members who had dropped the Uzi.
No, man, don't! He said. Please don't! We were just trying to have a little fun, that's all! Fun?
Said Steel, turning towards him.
Fun?
I'm sorry, man, the panicked gang member pleaded.
I'm sorry! Sorry doesn't get it,
Steel said, grabbing him by the shirt front. At that moment, the other gang member bolted past behind him toward the door. Without even looking, Steel raised his .45 and shot him in the back. The big slug knocked him off his feet and tore straight through his chest. He was dead before he hit the floor. The gang member he was holding by the shirt front came up with a knife, but Steel clubbed him on the head with the .45 and knocked it out from his grasp. At the same time, the one holding the girl started scrambling backward out the window onto the fire escape, dragging her after him. Steel took the whimpering gang member he was holding and hurled him one-handed across the room with all his might. He struck the opposite wall with a sickening crunch, leaving a huge wet spot on the wall, as was what was left of him, slid down to the floor. He moved quickly to the fire escape. The last gang member was just below him, dragging the girl down after him, one arm around her throat, the other on the railing, looking back over his shoulder fearfully. Steel stepped out onto the fire escape.
You stay right there, man!
His quarry called up to him.
You stay there, I'll kill her! I swear to God, I will!
Steel remained standing where he was, the red beams from his eyes locked onto the kid's face. The kid squirmed away, using the girl as a shield to hide behind as he struggled down the steps with her. She wasn't making a sound. Steel watched him until he got down to the bottom and swung down over the lower section of the fire escape with a loud creak. Holding the girl tightly around the waist, trying to conceal himself behind her, he started down. Steel vaulted over the railing. He dropped straight down 4 stories and landed on his feet, his nigh steel legs bending slightly at the knees to take the shock. The sidewalk cracked and buckled beneath him. He reached out and plucked the gang member off the bottom of the fire escape, grabbing him hard and squeezing, making him scream with pain and release his grip on the girl. He threw him to the ground. The kid landed hard several yards away and stayed there on the ground groaning. Steel walked over to him.
Get up!
He said.
Oh, Jesus! I said, get up!
He reached down and lifted him to his feet with one hand. The twin red beams bored into him as he looked up at Steel with defiant resignation. Blood was coming from his nose and mouth.
Fuck you, you lousy robot! Ah!
Steel roared with animal rage and hurled him against the side of the building with all his might. The body struck the wall and splattered, exploding from the impact as if it had fallen from the roof. Steel stood there, breathing hard and staring at the gory mess. The red light flickered from his eyes. Gang member's last defiant taunt continued to echo through his brain.
Lousy robot! Lousy robot! Lousy robot! Robot! Robot!
He lowered his head and brought his hand up to his face. Jesus Christ, he thought. As the murderous rage left him, he began to tremble. Oh, Jesus Christ. He didn't know how long he stood there, stunned by what he'd done, but suddenly he felt someone gently take hold of his hand. He looked down and saw the girl standing there and shivering slightly in her torn nightdress, heedless of her nakedness. She was looking up at him with concern.
Mister?
She said softly.
Are you all right?
Steel wanted to weep, but cyborgs couldn't cry. He nodded numbly.
My daddy,
said the girl, a look of anguished anxiety on her young features.
They hurt my daddy. Can you please help my daddy, mister?
Yeah, said Steel. Finding his voice. Yeah, come on, let's go help your daddy.
Dev Cooper was sitting on the sofa, trying not to stare at Raven's legs. It wasn't easy. The true test of a woman's legs, he thought, was if they looked good without the benefit of high heels. Raven Scarpetti had absolutely flawless legs, long, slim, and perfectly proportioned. And the short nighty showed a lot of them, nor was that all it showed.
When did he go out? Asked Cooper.
Right after he ripped the phone out of the wall,
she said, going over to the bar.
I'm going to make myself a drink. You want one?
She caught herself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot.
That's all right. Got any coffee?
I'll make some.
Listen, while you're at it, could you do me a favor?
Sure. What?
Could you put on a robe or something? I'm trying to be a gentleman, but it's kind of hard not to stare.
She smiled.
Well, At least somebody notices,
she said.
I'll be right back.
She went to the kitchen, and Dev could hear her puttering around. He was mildly surprised to find himself feeling a bit horny. He hadn't had any sex in a long time. Hadn't even thought about it, in fact. Between the drugs and the booze and the pressures of his job, his sex drive had been virtually non-existent. Perhaps this signaled a return to some sort of normalcy.
What do you mean, at least somebody notices? Steel been neglecting you?
He asked.
What's that?
She called from the kitchen.
I asked if Steel's been neglecting you.
Well, he's had a lot in his mind lately, but I guess you'd know all about that.
Not as much as I'd like, Dev said.
He lit up a cigarette.
He's not exactly the type who opens up very easily, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean,
she said, walking behind him as he sat on the couch. She went into the bedroom and reappeared a moment later wearing a man's terry robe and carrying a pack of cigarettes. She sat down on the couch beside him and lit up.
Coffee'll be ready in a minute.
Thanks!
You know anything about that phone call he got tonight?
She asked, curling her feet up underneath her on the couch as she turned to face him. The robe covered up a lot, but it didn't do much to reduce the effect of her proximity. Dev found it unsettling.
Yeah, I'm afraid I do, he said.
Is it something you can talk about, or is it more of that classified stuff?
She was trying to keep her voice sounding casual, but her concern was obvious.
I mean, you come in here at this time of night, I figure it has to be important.
It is, he said and took a deep breath. Look, Raven, you and I had never really talked much, but you realize I know all about you.
I know.
And I think you've been very good for Steel.
I know that too.
Well, he's gonna need your help. He needs my help too, but I don't know if he'll accept it.
It's the dreams, isn't it?
She said. Dev nodded.
Yes, but it's much more than that, he sighed. You have a right to know, and you're gonna need to know in order to help Steel through this.
She moistened her lips nervously.
If it'll help Steel, you know I'll do anything. But if this is one of those things where, as a psychiatrist, you shouldn't be telling me, then maybe.
Cooper shook his head.
No, it's not like that. Well, not exactly, anyway.
He blew his breath out.
It's pretty complicated. I'm not quite sure where to start. It's gonna take a while.
Okay, hold on. I'll go get your coffee.
She brought him the coffee, then sat back down on the couch and listened attentively, without interrupting, as Dev took it back from the beginning and told her all about the backup matrix. When he was through, she stared at him for a long moment without saying anything, then took a deep breath, exhaled heavily, and said,
Jesus fucking Christ.
You could say that again, said Dev.
And he doesn't know anything about it?
She asked. Dev shook his head.
Nah, he doesn't. And that call he received tonight was from the Matrix. I can imagine how he must have felt, suddenly hearing his own voice on the phone.
God,
said Raven.
I know exactly what he's thinking, too.
You do?
She nodded.
He thinks he's losing it. Ever since what happened to Mick Taylor, he's been afraid the same thing could happen to him. First the dreams, now this. Jesus, it must be tearing him apart.
Do you have any idea where he might have gone?
Asked Dev. She shook her head.
Can't you reach him on that broadcast link?
Higgins tried, and either it's not working or Steele's learned to block it. Higgins has put out a bulletin to all police cruisers in the city. If any of them spot him, they're to ask him to get in touch with Project Headquarters immediately. That doesn't mean he'll listen, and it would be foolhardy trying to arrest him. That could only set him off.
No man's land,
she said.
What?
That's where he would have gone. To no man's land.
Makes sense,
Cooper said, nodding.
Only where?
Midtown was surrounded by no man's land. Citizens generally referred to it simply that way, as no man's land. Strike Force cops tended to refer to it by a neighborhood, as in the old days, Harlem, the Heights, the Battery, Chinatown, Little Italy. Raven shook her head.
I couldn't guess. Maybe Ice would know. He should be in on this.
Cooper nodded.
I think you're right. I'll go down and get him.
He grimaced. Hope he's not irritable when he's woken up in the middle of the night.
It's almost morning,
Raven said.
I don't suppose he's a morning person.
Not really.
Dev grimaced again.
I was afraid of that.
If I'm not back in 5 minutes, send the Marines. Raven smiled.
If you're not back in 5 minutes, I'll send flowers.
Cute, said Dev. He took the elevator down a couple of floors to Ice's apartment. He hesitated at the door, his fingers poised over the buzzer. He swallowed nervously. He didn't know Ice very well. As far as he knew, nobody did, except for Steel and Raven. Ice made even Higgins nervous. No one knew very much about him. No one even knew his real name. For over a decade, he had led the Skulls, the most powerful street gang in the section of No Man's Land known as Harlem. He'd probably be still leading them if it hadn't been for Victor Borodini, the crime lord who's almost succeeded in bringing all the gangs in No Man's Land under his control. He'd made them all offers they couldn't refuse, all except for Ice, who, regardless of the benefits or the potential profits, wasn't about to start taking orders from some honky. Borodini's solution to that problem had been to sow dissent within the Skulls and have Ice deposed from leadership, after which he had put out a contract on him. It had been a very, very big mistake. Dev Cooper took a deep breath and hit the buzzer. He waited. He didn't dare to hit it twice. After a few moments, the door opened and Dev confronted an awesome sight. A man as black as midnight and as big as a house, his head completely shaved, his weightlifter's muscles straining the fabric of his black silk robe. His chest was about 60 inches in diameter, and his biceps were even larger than Dev's thighs. His huge lats flared down to a tiny, muscular waist, making him look like some kind of mutant manta ray with legs like tree trunks. His dark gaze settled on Dev unwaveringly. When he spoke, he sounded like the voice of doom.
Dr. Cooper,
he said in a basso profundo rumble, breaking the word doctor into two clearly separate syllables.
It be a mite early for house calls.
Dev cleared his throat uneasily. I'm sorry to trouble you at this hour, Ice.
No trouble. Yet. What be on your mind?
Could you, come up to Steel's place? We need to talk. He could be in trouble.
Be right up,
said Ice. He closed the door. A few moments later, they were all sitting in Steel's living room having coffee. Raven had gotten dressed. She was wearing boots and jeans and a red sweatshirt. Ice was dressed in his habitual all-black and dark shades, looking like the Prime Minister of Hell. Dev had repeated the story for his benefit.
Let me get this straight,
said Ice.
This Matrix? It'd be like another Steel? Some kind of clone?
You know about clones? Asked Dev.
Ice made a quick, flinching movement with his mouth that might have been a smile.
I read a book sometimes.
Dev felt foolish. Was it bigoted of him to assume that Ice was ignorant simply because he was from the ghetto? It probably was. Ice might have been uneducated in the formal sense, and he might speak in the cultural patterns of his environment, but he was literate and he was smart. In fact, Ice did quite a lot of reading, so as far as anybody knew, Ice had no social life. Or if he did, he kept it extremely private. He usually spent most of his spare time inside his sparsely furnished apartment, reading. Classical literature, mostly. Apparently, he'd been reading other things as well.
Well, yes, in a way, said Dev. A clone would be an excellent analogy. Only this is an electronic clone. It's an exact duplicate of Steel's personality, backed up from his original engram matrix, downloaded from his brain. Only it's much more than a simple backup program. It's live. It's an exact duplicate of Steel, and it's loose on the electronic net.
And I want to talk to its daddy,
I said.
I suppose that could be one way of putting it, said Dev.
And you didn't tell Steel about this.
Dev took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Nah, we didn't.
Higgins' orders, right?
Right.
That man's some piece of work.
You won't hear any argument from me, said Dev.
So now Higgins wants Steel to know about it, only because he hasn't got any other choice, said Raven.
There's a bit more to it than that, said Dev. I probably shouldn't be telling you this, but you might as well know the whole story. It seems that while the Matrix was loose inside Project Headquarters, he used the surveillance camera in Higgins' office to make a tape of him and Jennifer Stone making love.
Higgins and Dr. Stone?
Said Raven with astonishment. Dev nodded.
No shit. I didn't think the frigid bitch had it in her,
Raven said. I smiled.
And the Matrix be blackmailing them with the dirty movie.
That's about the size of it, said Cooper.
I chuckled.
I think I'd like to see that tape.
As far as you're concerned, you don't even know the tape exists, said Cooper.
He cleared his throat. pays.
What tape that be?
Asked Ice innocently. Thank you.
Is the Matrix any threat to Steel?
Raven asked. I don't know, said Dev. I shouldn't think so. I mean, it is Steel. Any chance that it might want to integrate with him? But even if it did, I'm not sure how that could possibly cause Steel any harm. It's an exact duplicate of the Matrix that he's already programmed with. It couldn't change him in any way. At least, I don't think so. But I don't know that for sure.
Who would know?
Asked Raven. If anybody would, it would be Jennifer Stone, said Cooper.
So the Matrix go anywhere electricity can go?
Asked Ice. Apparently. It seems to be able to travel anywhere it wants to in the electronic net.
Which means ain't no way of stopping it short of shutting everything down.
That's about it, Cooper replied.
Huh,
grunted Ice.
Means there's one Steel walking around, and another Steel can just go about anywhere he wants to go. Could make things mighty interesting. Anybody else know about the Matrix yet?
Just myself, Higgins, Dr. Stone, and you two. Plus some of the people in the project, but only those with top security clearance. Said Ice.
Bryce found out about it. He's going to have a cow.
I'm afraid that's putting it mildly. However, at the moment, I'm primarily concerned about Steel finding out about it. I don't want him thinking that he's losing his mind.
I hear that,
said Ice. He got up. Where are you going?
Gonna find Steel.
I'm coming with you,
Raven said.
No, girl, you stay here, Casey returned. Sides, ain't none too friendly where I gone look. Got to get some things together. Doctor, a few words with you before I leave?
Certainly, Cooper said, rising. Raven, someone should be coming by soon to repair the phone. I'll be at the office. If you hear anything...
I'll call,
she said.
You guys find him, okay?
We find him,
Ice replied. Cooper went out with him. Once they were in the elevator, Ice spoke without turning to him. He had a habit of doing that, of speaking to people without looking at them, just looking straight ahead. A holdover from his street gang days, Dev thought. It made him seem imperious. When you looked directly at you, it made him seem terrifying.
Didn't want to say this in front of Raven,
Ice said.
But I don't think Steel be coming back anytime soon.
What makes you think so? Dev asked, frowning.
Man think he be hearing voices. He gotta be thinking about his old partner. Way he done snapped and started killing people. You thinking he don't want to hurt Raven?
Yes, of course, said Dev. That should have occurred to me. I must not be thinking straight.
You're thinking fine,
said Ice.
You just don't know how the man thinks same way I do.
Cooper glanced at him. I ought to know, he said wryly. I'm supposed to be his damn psychiatrist.
Steel not a man to say what on his mind too often,
said Ice.
Old things in a lot.
I know that, Cooper agreed glumly. I just wish I knew how to get past that and get him to trust me the same way he seems to trust you.
Man don't give his trust,
said Ice.
You gotta earn it.
How? Asked Dev. What am I supposed to do? Go out on assignment with him and get myself shot at?
That don't mean nothing,
said Ice.
Any fool can get himself shot at.
So what the hell am I supposed to do? Asked Dev, feeling exasperated.
Stop trying to play doctor with the man. Doctor, stop pressing him. Stop digging. Give the man some room to breathe and try and understand him. Understand what makes the man tick.
Cooper felt like a horse's ass. Here he was, a trained psychiatrist, being lectured to by an uneducated layman. I've been trying to do precisely that, he said testily.
Bullshit, man. You not been straight with Steel. Why should he be straight with you?
Why indeed, thought Cooper. They reached Ice's floor and got out of the elevator.
Everything he tell you, man, you put down in some file someplace.
Ice continued, being unusually loquacious.
Everything he say, you try to pick apart.
But that's my job, said Dev.
Right,
said Ice.
I thought a doctor's job was to help his patient.
Dev stopped. Are you saying I'm not doing that? Ice stopped and turned to face him.
Man, talk to you and you... analyze,
he said, spitting out the word savagely.
Man, talk to me. I listen.
He opened the door of his apartment, went inside, and shut it right behind him. Right, said Dev to the empty hallway. End of chapter.